You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, good morning, everyone. And thank you for coming out this morning. And while we're at it, I want to thank Antoine and Emily Van Ockmel of the Sunrise Charitable Foundation for their support of our independent research. Antoine has been deeply interested in the interplay of tech, place, and equity for years, and we really appreciate that. So I'm Mark Muro, senior fellow here at Brookings, and what I want to do is briefly tee up our discussion about how regional technology hubs, a concept very much under discussion in Congress this summer, can help push back against the nation's racial and regional divides. Proposed initially by scholars here at Brookings, ITIF, and MIT, tech hubs are envisioned as federally recognized focal points for channeling flexible funds for R&D, workforce training, entrepreneurship, and placemaking into promising regions so we can help new places achieve faster growth, a faster trajectory. Now, today, we want to look beyond the competitiveness dimension, though, as important as that is. Instead, I want to suggest that regional tech hubs are a compelling way to advance economic inclusion because they provide an opportunity for regions to center equity in their growth initiatives. So I'm going to say a few words about hubs as an equity agenda, and then we'll hear from some others. First, we'll hear from Representative Haley Stevens from Michigan, who chairs the House Science Committee's Subcommittee on Research and Technology, and who will play a role in shaping what Congress does this month and this fall in these issues. After that, my colleague Rodney Sampson, an investor, entrepreneur, author, and teacher, will lead a great panel of regional leaders and creators who are already focused on inclusive tech in new places and thinking about how regional tech hubs could help. Right now, though, let's look at why regional tech hubs matter so much. The first reason for the hub's relevance is the stark divergence of U.S. places on measures of economic and innovation performance. We've been tracking these trends at Brookings, and it's clear the nation's regions and metro areas, which were once converging when you looked at wages or job growth, coming closer together, have been growing apart. Most notably, these trends have been especially stark in the critical innovation sector. A cross-section of the nation's most essential R&D and STEM worker industries that we follow. Looking closely at these regions, we showed in our original report proposing growth centers that a short list of high-tech coastal superstar metros have hugely outstripped the growth of all other places. Notably, just five innovation metros, Boston, San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, San Diego, you know, the usual suspects, accounted for more than 90% of the nation's innovation sector job growth during the years 2005 to 2017. By contrast, 90% of the metros, nation's metros, actually lost share of this critical sector, and many actually lost absolute jobs in this sector, which is the first reason we need to counter business as usual with an urgent tech hubs initiative. Powerful winner-take-most dynamics are concentrating U.S. tech into just a few fortunate places. And we need to push back on that because it's not likely that this will simply self-correct. But we also need to push back on the diversity problem implicit in all of this. Regional disparities stage equity gaps. To begin with, the facts of the nation's regional disparities are unfair in social terms. We can put it as simple as that, many cities in the South and Midwest are lacking real traction in tech means that tens of millions of citizens, Black, Brown, Native American, Asian, are being seriously disadvantaged with respect to job opportunities, income possibilities, health and happiness outcomes. where people live is a huge determinant of their economic opportunities. We know that. And so the nation's hyper-concentrated economic geography is enforcing a kind of economic segregation. But beyond that, let's also remember that the nation's whole innovation sector is itself heavily white. That's because systemic inequities in America's economy and in tech have reinforced a history of exclusion from much of the innovation enterprise in America. And so looking at just those 13 industries in the innovation sector I just mentioned, we find that Black and brown workers together now make up just 16% of the nation's employment base, about half their share of the population. To be sure, that representation varies somewhat by region, and we have some inclusive tech strong stories, but overall, underrepresentation is the rule in the U.S. innovation sector, all of which means that the nation is losing out on Black and brown talent, ideas, and innovations all over America to its detriment. So it's clear that any regional tech hubs initiative should and can as a place serve as place-based centers for helping to promote economic inclusion. Regional hubs in 10 to 15 places, say, can function as focal points for concerted work by which places use federal resources to build inclusive R&D and innovation programs, promote STEM skills and exposure to edge technologies, particularly for Black and brown learners and workers, scale up entrepreneurship in a concerted way, invest in new companies, invest in placemaking, supportive of accessible tech activity, creating, rich, diverse ecosystems. In short, any future hubs in building U.S. competitiveness should also serve as centers for building inclusive local tech ecosystems that support diversity and equity metro by metro. And so with that, I'd like to turn the floor over to Representative Stevens to continue our program. Haley, who's immersed in House discussions of these issues and more, will give her view of the opportunity before us. After Haley, Rodney Sampson will take over and moderate a conversation with three exponents of inclusive tech from Kansas City, Birmingham, and Jackson, where some of that work is really already starting. We're not starting at zero, but we need to move forward. So Haley, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Mark, and to the Brookings community for having today's very topical and important discussion. This event is absolutely happening at a critical juncture as Congress looks to make the largest investment in federal research and development in several decades, with a very intentional approach to catalyzing regional innovation, harnessing the potential and the opportunity of localities to drive our innovation and making abilities forward. In recent decades, we know that economic growth has, in the United States of America, as much as it has accelerated and transformed economies of scale, that economic growth has become increasingly concentrated in a relatively just small number of cities and regions. So, for instance, between 1980 and 2016, the top 10 metro areas in the United States saw their earnings grow 57% more than anywhere else in the country. And so as we talk about on-ramps to opportunity and on-ramps to economic growth, it is imperative that we take a holistic and inclusive approach, not only with regional diversity and inclusion, but also population diversity and inclusion. According to a recent report from the Brookings Institution, more than a third of American jobs in high-growth innovation industries, such as technology, computer manufacturing, biotech, telecommunications, are located in just 16 counties in the United States of America. And while we absolutely celebrate the success of innovation hubs and look to the success of innovation hubs like Silicon Valley and what we see in the Boston MIT corridor and continue to support their role in advancing U.S. competitiveness, we must look to the rest of the country and populations that are being left behind. For if the United States is to be and remain globally competitive, we absolutely want to address the issues hindering geographic diversity and economic growth and have an intentional strategy to address some of the root causes for increasing social and economic disparities throughout our country. For instance, as Mark mentioned, populations and demographics being left behind by our innovation sector, we can look to wealth creation as a great example of these disparities. African-American, Black families, households have a median income of, a median wealth in their household of $24,000 as compared to white households that have a median wealth of $188,000. We have 3.5 Black households with a negative net worth in the United States of America. And as the federal government has long been a partner in building and catalyzing regional innovation economies through the through many agencies that touch innovation strategies with different missions, it is now a part of our charge to look at the approach of regional economies that are self-selecting to become accelerators for various research concentrations, manufacturing capabilities, technology corridors, and on. We've seen that President Biden shares the core mission of the Economic Development Administration. And in his American Jobs Plan, he's calling for supercharging federal support for regional innovation by investing $20 billion in the Economic Development Administration grants process to develop upwards of 10 regional innovation hubs. Obviously, we've seen what's come out of the Senate, which is a notch up from that with the still $20 billion. But such a plan, if and when it's enshrined into law and implemented carefully, will spark economic activity, certainly build community wealth. It must and continue to bring individuals who have been left behind. And that is what we're seeing here today on our panel, which I am so honored to kick off. This STEM education and training opportunities on ramps to harnessing new opportunities for individuals by getting them certifications and plugging them in to jobs and technology corridors. And as we all know, in this space, it can't come from the top down. It must come from the bottom up. And as we look at the intentionality of technology and regional innovation hubs, they will come from the bottom up. They will come because regions come together, put forward applications drawing down on community colleges, training programs, existing small businesses in various technology corridors, and their own human capital through that will be networked through a variety of different sources. And if you allow me, I'll just quickly say that this is what we have shown time and time again in my home state of Michigan, certainly a great history that began in the 20th century with automobiles and an entire innovation ecosystem that built up around it. And for a long time in the United States of America, these types of things happened organically. They didn't happen because we had the 10,000 foot view perch that we have today through the great access of data and new systems and connectivity. And we cannot rely on old organic models of technology and regional economic development. We can certainly look to our past. And again, in Michigan, as we were putting the world on wheels in 1912, the nation's first highway materials testing lab was opened in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the home to the University of Michigan. In 1918, a police officer from Detroit invented and installed our nation's first four-way red, yellow, and green electric traffic light at the corner of Woodward and Michigan Avenues in downtown Detroit. And in 1960, Michigan became the first state to complete a border-to-border interstate. And now, today, in the 21st century, we continue to double down on this innovation prowess. But it is not so organic. Rather, it is buoyed by organizations that are capturing and harnessing cybersecurity potentials in our advanced manufacturing sector. It is harnessed by organizations that are bringing in the Internet of Things, the industrial Internet of Things, to localize and source not only the original designing, but also the production and shipment of goods that is taking place throughout the vast manufacturing potential that exists from our automotive sector that is diversified in the aerospace and defense sectors. And so while we remain enthusiastic about putting forward and seeing signed into law real money to support technology regional innovation hubs throughout this country that will allow us to compete and not continue to leave behind the talent of America, this is going to be an all hands on deck process, which is frankly why today we are assembled in this panel and delving into some of the assets that exist around the country and where we might see the regional innovation approach manifest and ultimately be successful. And that is part of our focus right now on the Science Committee, which I proudly serve on in partnership with our overview of what is driving innovation at the U.S. Department of Commerce to the National Science Foundation to the National Institute of Standards and Technologies. And I'll just say in conclusion, coming out of the vast challenges of COVID-19, and we know it forced us to look inward. It forced us to look not only within our own households, but across our neighborhoods and how we access jobs and why we access jobs. That continues to be a great springboard opportunity for the investment to come in regional innovation hubs. The response to supply chain challenges, recognizing if we make and buy and sell in America, we will continue to be successful. But we can't just say those things because they sound good. We've got to come up with a holistic set of strategies that really grab onto what exists in the regions across this country and bring in the talent to say, we need you. The imperative is today that we need you to connect into these technology and advanced manufacturing opportunities so that we can continue to drive forward the opportunities for the future that are really within our grasp. So with that, I want to thank you again, Brookings, for having today's conversation. I want to pass it over to Mr. Rodney Sampson, who I am really looking forward to hearing from as he moderates today's discussion. The future truly is the limit. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevens, for your intuitive and in-tune remarks. Once again, good morning. I'm Rodney Sampson. I am a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and I also have the privilege of serving as executive chairman and CEO of Opportunity Hub, affectionately known as OHUB. Mark, thank you for your partnership in this work and for co-hosting today's event. I want to begin today's conversation by first thanking the over 700 people who registered to attend today's event. And I want to be intentional about centering today's conversation on equity, racial equity in particular, in the innovation sector in particular. Why? Well, the data doesn't lie. By 2053, the projected median wealth of a Black family is zero. And by 2073, it's projected to be zero for Latinx families. Per McKinsey & Company, Black America will lose 4.5 million jobs due to automation. And that's been accelerated because of the COVID-19 pandemic in the next 10 years. Today's technology ecosystem's racial gap is 1.1 million Black and Latinx Americans, costing these communities $50 billion annually. That's $1 trillion in the next 20 years. Last year, we saw more than 39% unemployment in the Black community, while the technology ecosystem was raising over $156 billion in venture capital and hiring at an accelerated rate. In the startup ecosystem, we saw last year less than 1% again of all venture capital going to Black founders. And according to the research by our friends at Harlem Capital, there have only been 305 Black and Latinx high-growth technology startup founders that have raised over $1 million in venture capital in the last 20 years. I'm waving high because I was one of them over 20 years ago. 305 versus nearly 12,000 in 2020. 1 year, 2020. It is clear that equity, again, racial equity, should be the center of any and all innovation sector focused policy. I emphatically believe that a framework for measurable diversity, equity, and solutions, DAIS, such as the certification we've created with UNC Chapel Hill, Kenyon Flagler, with Duke University and Stanford, should be operationalized throughout the federal funding, even the selection process. And on the ground in the regional technology hubs development at the land acquisition, dirt up multi-use construction, rapid upskilling, hiring, commercialization, startup programming, acceleration, and early stage investment and access to markets as we present in our codified work with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. This should be a part of the selection process of these regional hubs. Racial equity must be front and center. DAIS must be front and center. If we get this right, we have the opportunity to reset the American ideal, construct, and dream so that everyone everywhere in this nation can equitably participate in the technology ecosystem, future of work, fourth industrial revolution, and beyond as a path to shared prosperity and multi-generational wealth creation with no reliance on pre-existing multi-generational wealth. This will be our nation's competitive and unfair advantage globally. With that, let me welcome my three esteemed guests to the virtual Brookings stage today. Sherry Gonzalez, she is a vice president at KC Rising and the Civic Council in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Sherry, how are you? Good to have you. Next is Wayman Jackson. He is the founder and CEO of Ed Farm in Birmingham, Alabama. Wayman, good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And Dr. Nashley Cephas, who is the founder and CEO of The Bean Path in Jackson, Mississippi. Nashley, good to see you.
Hey, thanks. Same here.
Absolutely. Well, all right, let's get to work. First up, I would like, in this order, Sherry, and then Wayman and Nashley, talk a little bit about your respective work today and a little bit about your journey to this point as archetypes in this work of ensuring racial equity in regional tech hubs. Sherry?
Sure. Thank you. So you mentioned I'm VP of the Civic Council. So what is the Civic Council? It's a CEO member organization, invitation only, and some of the largest firms in our city. The top priority of the Civic Council is an effort called KC Rising. KC Rising is a regional collective consensus really focused on economic growth that includes everyone by connecting people and organizations around common goals. We are business-led, metrics-driven, and focused on the long term. Some of the efforts we have been focusing on is traded sectors. What are those areas that we are competitive in nationally and globally? How do we sort of distinguish that? And so we want to play to our strengths. One of those sectors we've identified is biologics. There is nearly 300 life science industry firms in Kansas City, growing by double-digit percentages each time we sort of survey that. It is a prime destination for contracted pharmaceutical research for the U.S. and also internationally because of our high concentration of contract research organizations. The presence here is because of Marion Laboratories many years ago. And so biologics, they're the sort of living organism or containing components, products containing components of living organisms, things like vaccines, right? Very important to us, therapies that treat disease. These help both human and animal health. And so what we have been looking at is where Kansas City differentiates. We have a real opportunity in the heartland because of our connection to agriculture, our strength in manufacturing, to lead in pharmaceutical manufacturing, and especially as we're looking to onshore some of that in places like China, the supply chain that was talked about previously. These also create good and promising jobs that are pathways to the middle class for individuals that, as we have talked about, are being left behind and creating a wealth gap. But we don't want to stop there, just sort of creating good and promising jobs. Another area of strength is really in design. We have more than 20 global headquarters. If you don't count just global headquarters, there's more than 5,000 employers in the engineering, architecture, and construction industry. We have led many ways in sports architecture and green architecture and some of that industrial design. There's a little bit to know about Kansas City. We are by state with economic assets on both sides of the state line, but redlining had a huge impact on our community and continues to have a huge impact on the economy and our city. It's still highly concentrated and segregated in by poverty and sort of racial lines and geography. And so what we're trying to do is stand up an innovation district known as Keystone in the part of town that has experienced historical divestment. Keystone is aligned with the design industry. This would bring tech training to the community to fill jobs that are in high demand. In fact, we're looking at partnering with OHUB in some of that. We would also be looking at placement of those and then supporting diverse entrepreneurs with venture capital and support for scaling of their business. And then taking those ideas to market and using this place-based strategy in community. The governance structure of this effort, it speaks to the equity that we are trying to build. We have continued to involve the community in the development of it. So why would something like this regional tech hubs be important to our community? We have the assets, we have the vision. What we don't have is the financial support. At the state level, we do lack that support in many ways for entrepreneurs and innovation. And again, it's hard because we're by state. KC also doesn't have a public or private institution with a large endowment that can just write a check for this. We do have engagement from our corporations, but as was mentioned before, much of that wealth exists in a few places with a few companies. So we don't have something the size of Google or Facebook that could underwrite the effort. So we need that federal investment to realize the potential of innovation, of commercialization, and taking these ideas to scale, and in particular to create an opportunity for equitable growth and development in our community.
Thank you, Sherry. I'm going to come back to you after we do kind of the contextual introductions to talk a little bit of more specifically about how the Civic Council is approaching racial equity with some of the work that we're doing. So thank you for that. Wayman, tell us about yourself, Ed Farm, and the work you're doing in Birmingham and now Atlanta and beyond.
Yeah, thanks, Rodney, and thanks, Brookings, for pulling this together. I really appreciate you mentioning me as founder. I am CEO of Ed Farm. But when I talk about Ed Farm, I would like to say that Ed Farm was an initiative that was founded by the community in Birmingham. It's been an amazing opportunity for us to look at the assets that we actually had in Birmingham. I would say this dated back at least about 5 years ago, where our community really took a strong look at, you know, what is it that we are now and what is it that we actually want to be. We had a group of stakeholders that included our current mayor, individuals from UAB, Alabama Power, the city, who all came together around a collective impact or a collective mission of moving Birmingham forward as it relates to economic development and workforce development. And at the top of that was us actually using data to find out, you know, where were the jobs going to be for our city and our region over the next 10 years? What were we missing? What were we lacking now? A lot of that information came back and basically said a few things. One, that like many other communities across the country, that we had a population that was heavily underskilled, low-skilled occupation, low-skilled jobs, low-skilled wages. In order for us to, as a community, compete in the new economy and the future economy, we needed to make an investment in talent in our people. We needed to make an investment in entrepreneurship. We needed to look at the fact that we got back information that said over the next 10 years, we were going to have six times as many jobs in computer science that required at least a bachelor's degree than we would actually have talent to fill those jobs. From that, you know, our community really took a hard look at itself and said, you know, what are we going to do to address and to fix this issue? A group, a coalition of us had this amazing opportunity to actually pitch this idea to Apple. Around, you know, this is, you know, where we're going and these are the needs that we have as a community. And lo and behold, after I would say about a year and a half, we were actually able to secure, I think, a seed or startup investment through this partnership with Apple to launch what Ed Farm is here in Birmingham. And so Ed Farm is a nonprofit organization based in Birmingham, Alabama. Our vision is one that we envision an inventive world where all people have access to the job, to the skills that they need to fill or create the jobs of the future. And so how do we do that with what we started off here? A lot of the work that we that came back and that we knew that we needed to get into a space of doing was upskilling our community. And so we took an approach where we wanted to start at the K-12 level of cohorting educators around immersive learnings in technology and in computer science and coding and helping these educators then transfer that information to their curriculum with students. We knew that, you know, the jobs of the future were going to require some level of digital literacy and digital skills. And so not just completely focusing on making sure that we were having a coding boot camp, but that we were actually able to offer something to our community that could provide them with just the basic entry level digital skills through a path through a program that we have now called Pathways, which is a 14-week coding boot camp that uses Apple's Swift-based language. But essentially what it really is doing is giving people an opportunity in our community to move from one place where they are, where they may have low code or no code skills, to actually being able to have the opportunity to gain digital literacy, problem-solving skills, all those things that employers are saying that they want and need. Our most recent venture, where you mentioned about Atlanta, not only are we doing this work in Birmingham and beginning to spread, you know, our K-12 and community coding initiatives across the state, but we also recently, earlier this year, had the opportunity to launch in partnership with Apple and in partnership with Southern Company, what will become the Propel Center, which will be a state-of-the-art facility that's positioned within the Atlanta University Center. And set to serve all 101 historically Black colleges and universities. And so what we're having the opportunity to do is to really work on the ground with those populations that we know need access and opportunity to the jobs of the future. What I think is so innovative about this approach around a regional economy, oftentimes I think that we think of economies, you know, city and then metro as far as the metro area. But Birmingham and Atlanta are 2 hours situated within each other. And Jackson, as Nichelle will say, is another, you know, 3 hours away. to the West, when you begin to think about making investments, like the type of investments that organizations like ours, OHUB, and others are doing across the Southeast, that truly begins to form a regional approach around talent, and then growing companies and also being able to recruit companies to an area that is, one, saturated with diverse talent. And that's really one of the things that, you know, we're really focusing on our work on. So glad to have the opportunity to be on and look forward to sharing more about the work that we're doing.
Absolutely. Just to double click on one point you mentioned, really being this, building this sort of kind of regional ecosystem where we're building a density of skilled and experienced talent. Oftentimes when we think of underrepresented, underserved, socially disadvantaged, there's so many titles to define, none of them that are that positive, to be honest with you. But oftentimes when we talk about upskilling in those communities, we're still talking about upskilling into low-income roles in the technology sector, whereas we have all seen where we can pathway folks to upwardly mobile in-demand roles as well. So thank you for your work on the early side of the spectrum. Dr. Nashley, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like for you to also tell us about your journey and the work that you're doing in Jackson, Mississippi as well.
Yeah, so again, I really appreciate you all for inviting me to be on this panel this morning. And I plus one everything that's been said here this morning. This is an amazing group of people doing the work, because it takes work. It's not easy. It's not going to happen automatically. And so it takes someone kind of going out, taking some risk and saying, hey, I want to make sure we push this through. And then usually you get the support to follow. And so I'm happy to be a part of this group. And so I'll just kind of start by telling a little bit about my background, my story, because it is really what led me to be a strong believer that you can provide opportunities for people who lack those opportunities, but they're brilliant people. But once you give them a chance, you give them that opportunity, you show them the way, they will take it and run with it. And I'm a living witness and a product of that belief. As someone who's actually also based in Atlanta, but I'm back and forth between Jackson, Mississippi and Atlanta. And I know with Rodney here and Opportunity Hub, one of the first opportunity ecosystem builders in Atlanta regarding tech and tech education. And I remember those early years. I was a student at Georgia Tech. And so definitely applaud all the work you've been doing and being able to adapt and still remain relevant in everything that you're doing in the area. And so I think that for me, Atlanta was a huge part of my influence and wanted to say, okay, wow, there are some people here, especially in the Black community, that are doing some amazing things. I can take that back to places like a Jackson, Mississippi, where I was born and raised, where I didn't necessarily see the progression in terms of technology and STEM the way that I saw it in other surrounding areas, as well as having lived in Silicon Valley, having lived in New York City. I have a PhD from Georgia Tech in computer engineering. My specialty is artificial intelligence. And I went to undergrad at Mississippi State University in computer engineering. And I remember when I first started, got my first job role as a CTO, a chief technology officer at a startup called ParkPig. I honestly did not know what a startup was. Now, I had a PhD in computer engineering from Georgia Tech. I didn't know that people will give you money for your ideas that you haven't even fully built yet. Apparently, this is how Silicon Valley was built. But people in my community didn't know that. People in my community didn't have access to that type of capital, access to that type of knowledge to even be empowered to do so. And this is a problem. And since, of course, having been that CTO of that startup, we were successfully acquired by Amazon. We sold the company in 2016. I now work at Amazon as a AI expert for them on various roles. We also focus on things like fairness and biases in AI. And having taken that knowledge and seeing what technology can do, what STEM fields can do, a lot of people don't know that for someone who has no background, no education in STEM, they can essentially self-teach themselves in about 6 months and start making six figures. Now, when you talk about generational wealth, people who have not been allowed access to that type of knowledge or that type of career path, if the only thing you've been told is, hey, you have to go to school, you have to take this path, you have to do this in order to be successful, or you can just, you know, go back to the streets. That's not what the story has been told in Silicon Valley. Look at the majority of leaders of tech companies actually don't even have a PhD. They don't even have a background in technology. And so when you start to tell people that, hey, you can be a part of this tech ecosystem too, you don't necessarily have to be the coder. You can be the founder. You can be the investor. You can be the person who is educating the younger people as teachers to understand, hey, this is a field. This is a possibility for you. And so what I did was I took that and I said, okay, when we started the Bean Path, my team and I in Jackson, Mississippi, we just wanted to make things like AI, cryptocurrency, Internet of Things, cybersecurity. We wanted to make those household names. If I were to set up shop in Silicon Valley and say, hey, I'm going to give away free AI advice, I would have a line down the street and around the corner. Now, when I do that same thing, I set up shop in Jackson, Mississippi, on the corner. First of all, they're going to be like, why is she out there? It's too hot outside. And then secondly, they're going to be like, you know, why am I here? Why do I even want to know about AI? What is AI? And that is something that I wanted to change. And this is happening in places all over like Jackson. But I wanted to make sure that I was a part of the solution there and not part of the problem. And so what I also thought was we started doing the Bean Path in 2018. When we first started, no one was coming. And so we would set up in the local libraries. So we refined our marketing techniques, refined our target market. And before you know it, before the libraries even opened, we had people lined up, 15 people at the door waiting to come in to get the tech help that they needed from our experts at the Bean Path, whether it was help with their tech company, whether they needed help mentoring their children, or if they just were a senior citizen and needed help with their devices, because your grandchildren always won't help you with your devices. So you can come to the Bean Path. And so we were a very viable resource to people in those community. And of course, after COVID, we went virtual. And we're still able to help over 400 people with just the staff that we had working on weekends. And so I then began to think, okay, how can we scale what we're doing? We need real estate. We need a place to call our own. And so I started looking for property. I ended up purchasing in fall of last year during COVID, 14 acres of land in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. I now have 8 buildings. We're going to tear down 2, renovate 6, and build 5 new construction buildings. And I'm calling it the Jackson Tech District. Of course, I have a team and all of that that helps me. I'm not a real estate developer, but I'm learning a lot. I'm learning that these things are being built all around us and we can do it too. And rest assured, I'm going to definitely show others how to do it as well. And so we have a live, work, play tech hub where you can have the tech training, the entrepreneurship center, also the restaurants, the venue center, the concerts, the festivals. You got to bring the people out. You got to meet them where they are. If you do that, you bring them out, then you start sprinkling hackathons, you start sprinkling robotics competitions. And before you know it, the whole community is involved with this tech awareness that they didn't have knowledge to prior to that. And so I'm very excited again to be here, and I'll hand it back over to you, Rodney.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nashley. Wow. Just listening to all of you, I am inspired. Yes, of course, by your personal journeys, but you know, I'm approaching 50, and as I start looking at what the next, you know, part of my life will look like, I'm starting to think about processes and systems for scale, but smart, you know, and not just hard. When you're doing things by yourself, it can be incredibly hard, especially when you're talking about equity and racial equity. And each of you represent models and systems and frameworks that can be codified and duplicated. And that's what we've done at the Opportunity Hub. It's taken us nearly a decade to do that. When we first, to your point, Natalie, we're talking about startups and tech hubs and coding boot camps and sales boot camps and hackathons and venture funds and pitch competitions. Very, very astute people, including a lot of politicians, would roll their eyes at us and say, oh, that's cute. That's for the kids. And I'm like, wait, no, this is what's creating jobs. 60% of net new jobs in this country are coming from startups that are fueled by only 3% of our country's capital stack. Only 3%. I know a lot of folks will say, well, what about Main Street? What about small businesses? Absolutely. They contribute to our GDP. However, as we accelerate into the fourth industrial revolution, we're going to have to pivot to make sure that Black people, Latinx people, Indigenous people, poor people, people from communities that might not be obvious centers of innovation, we have to make sure that they are also in this technology ecosystem and fourth industrial revolution. Before we get to the Q&A, we're going to have about 10 minutes of Q&A. I want each of you to talk about a model. It's a two-part assignment. Talk about one model that you're working on, and if you could wave a wand, how much money do you need to fulfill your mission at scale? And I'll just kick it off and give an example. You know, we took the OHUB model, took the best of it, and have now codified it in what we're calling innovation and equity districts. And the mission is to upskill 1.1 million Black and Brown folks into in-demand technology jobs and to accelerate 10,000 high growth Black and Brown startups. And the cost of that, $33 billion. All right, Sherry, you're up first.
Well, I wouldn't have a price tag like $33 billion, but one of the things, I mean, we're working with you, right? And so a portion of that actually affects what we're doing. But you know, so one of the things Casey Rising does is we look at how our growth relates to other cities, right? So Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Nashville, Austin, Denver, those are some of what we would consider benchmark cities in our geographic region. And our tech growth is relatively competitive with those. The problem is what we've all been talking about, the diversity in the tech workforce isn't. And so we are seeing like maybe 7% of the tech workforce is Black or African American, which is not representative of the percentage in the community, 4% Latinx, again, maybe half of what's represented in the community. And even as women, we're not even at half of what is represented in the community. And so we've been focusing a lot on building that ecosystem. I have not put a total price tag on it, but what I do know is that it's in at least the tens of millions initially, right? Like if we could get an investment of 25 million or 30 million, what it would do to allow us to start to scale some of what is happening within the communities would be worthwhile. Now, if that was over the course of years, say 10 years, where we would be on the other end, I think would have different outcomes, both in what the industry looks like, as well as the wealth building that we are all talking about and tracking personally in Kansas City. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I would like it to not just be a one-time check, but sort of be an investment over a decade. It took us years to get here. Let's actually make that investment over a long period as well.
Absolutely. And I think you've made the case. If they were making a decision today, Kansas City should definitely be one of those regional tech hubs. Wayman.
So I'm going to take approach. I'll go quick and do two projects right quick. Yeah. So when you think of what we're doing in Atlanta with Propel and this vision of serving 101 HBCUs with, you know, artificial intelligence, machine learning, all these great new and different future workforce related skills, that when you look around and think that, you know, many of these 101 HBCUs are not at parity and they don't have those, we're quickly approaching $150 million project. For this to be a thing and for it to be truly reality, you know, this is definitely an investment that gets into the space of $500 million to $750 million so that you can adequately make sure that the resources of what you're trying to do by building a virtual dynamic platform and a center and a space and actually eliminating barriers that, you know, many entrepreneurs, student founders face when they're trying to come out of college and start their own company. Has, you know, that gets in the ballpark. What we're doing, I would say, in the Birmingham space, when you start thinking about an organization that's working at the top of the funnel, Rodney, that you mentioned about being, you know, how do you prepare communities? How do you prepare people before they become entrepreneurs, before they go into a true coding bootcamp? For us to scale the model, you know, that we have now, that is truly looking at something that over the course of being able to put this in 10 to 15 other cities and partnering with organizations like OHUB and others, $100 to $150 million project to really annually to be able to set this up as a model to do this and impact, you know, have equity impact in communities of color across the country.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for your transparency. And I can tell that both of you have definitely thought through this. And so we definitely got to make sure that Birmingham and Atlanta are on that list as well. Nashley?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Bean Path is definitely been operation since 2018. We are currently in the process of raising funds. I would say we have a potential grantor for almost $1 million. That will keep us going for to be able to scale like all over Mississippi within the next couple of years. With the Tech Hub, the Jackson Tech District we're building, it is $150 million project. So the first phase is about $25 million. We have three phases total. And there's several different ways to get those funds. There's a very diverse capital stack, including grant funding. And then there's also, I didn't mention this, but we do have, I recently co-founded a lab space in Atlanta, right down the street from Georgia Tech. Some of my Georgia Tech colleagues, we started called KIT Lab, stands for KITT, Knowledge, Information, Technology, and Tools. And we just wanted a place for Black STEM professionals to be able to call their home and hang out, have meetings and be able to collaborate and work on different things with lab spaces like electronics lab and 3D printers and have workshops and things like that. So we're excited about all of that. I think we have a nonprofit model there as well. And so I think building that community, we could use all the help we can get, in other words. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think for those who are listening, whether you're policymakers or work in industry or perhaps in the media as well, you can see that these are not performative investments. And I believe it was Arlen Hamilton a couple days ago on Twitter. And I wholeheartedly agree and have also made comments to this as well, is that when I hear about 1 million, 5 million, 10 million, you know, 3 million or what have you announcements, I always go look at the organization and look at the size of the company and look at sort of like the market, their market share, or if they're saying we're investing $5 million into Black founders, but I know you have a venture fund that invests $5 billion, it doesn't quite add up. But what I want to applaud you all specifically here today is that you're not building programs that are performative. These are not pilot programs for just press releases. These are sustainable models that are measurable. And I think that's what's key, and the fact that they're built in racial equity from the onset. It's not a reactive approach like, oh yeah, let me go back and let me include equity. Let me make sure that Black people are at the table, that Latinx people are at the table, that Indigenous people are at the table, making sure that Black women are at the table, Black LGBTQIA, Black veterans, Black differently able. We don't have to go back and say, oh yeah, I forgot someone. We are intentionally inclusive from the beginning. And I believe that's the signal that we want to put forth today. Okay, so we have a few minutes left for questions. and we'll get through as many of these as possible. Thanks, everyone, for your patience. Thanks for submitting your questions as well. If we do not get to your questions here, please use the hashtag TechHubs, and at our mutuality or convenience today, we may jump onto Twitter, you never know, and all respond. Just be patient with us, because normally after these events, we get inundated with requests to connect. So thank you for your understanding. So here's the first question that I'm going to direct towards Wayman. This is kind of a layup for you. Does it make sense to partner with HBCUs or technical colleges to establish these hubs?
Absolutely. I would say that HBCUs are a hidden treasure. When you look, some of the research that we did, companies are saying that they want the best, the brightest, and diversity is a huge focus right now. And so when you look across the Southeast, if you take, Jackson, Alabama, and Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, I'm probably missing one, but about 65% of all historically Black colleges and universities are located within that. So the amount of talent, African-American talent, talent of color, females of color that you have access to by partnering with those HBCUs is tremendous. And then the universities and colleges themselves are just at a space of being very open and flexible about building out what true partnerships look like with industry. And then when you really start thinking about two-year colleges and technical colleges, companies now want, fast, quick, ready individuals that can get into jobs. And the freedom and flexibility that a company has to work with a two-year system or a technical college to develop them into to something that is a job that they can go immediately into, it's a win-win for everyone.
Excellent. Thank you for your response. Nashley, this question is for you. What is the best way or best practices to attract and engage women, particularly Black or Latinx women, into the technology ecosystem or these regional tech hubs?
Yeah, so you want to make sure that you show that they can advance in their careers. And one way of doing that is by having advanced careered women in your organization. That means making sure that when they come in, not just sourcing diverse talent, very aggressively and very intentionally, but also when they arrive, make sure they're included. Make sure that they're involved, make sure they have a voice, and make sure that you're taking them seriously and understanding that it's a privilege for them to be there, not the other way around. And I think also there's been several studies. I know the National Society of Black Engineers, Society of Women Engineers show that when you have mentors in place, that is a very significant catalyst and push as well. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
Excellent. Thank you for your response. Sherry, what can CEOs, particularly of large companies, what can they do concretely to support initiatives to ensure that these regional technology hubs are equitable, inclusive, and diverse?
There's a lot of things that CEOs can do. It's hard to answer in the few minutes we have left. But one of the things we have been sort of asking CEOs to do is to, yes, give to these efforts, of course, but how can they give is many, many ways. Yes, writing checks, but we want to make sure that they're doing what Dr. Sfis just said, right? That they're bringing in talent that is diverse, that represents what they espouse to want to be doing internally in their companies. We also want to make sure that the dollars that they spend are with diverse companies. We need the cash for these companies to grow, for the founders to be able to continue to grow that innovation. And so we have a number of firms that have made a pledge to do more in that space and are fulfilling that pledge, although the pledges are new. And then we also want them to engage, as was mentioned, as mentors and creating real opportunities for both the founders and not just sort of the talent within their company. And so those are some of the ways that we actually ask them to engage. There's many more, but.
Absolutely. And I'm definitely, as a follow-on to that, I'm excited about some of the work that we're doing in Kansas City that we'll be announcing in the coming weeks to work with CEOs. And we ask that you work with us, you trust us. If you don't know all the answers as it relates to DAIS, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion solutions, we're here for that. Let us be the experts and we'll work with you. Last question, and I'll open it up to all. If we build racial equity into the regional tech hubs and this funding and the work on the ground, how do you think this will assist in closing the racial wealth gap and building generational wealth in minority communities? Waven, let's start with you.
I think it's a start. It's definitely a start in the right direction. But knowing the amount of work that it's going to take, you know, one, just to catch up. I look at, you know, the work that Brookings, the Metro team did with the city of Birmingham. I think one of the statistics that came back that we were, you know, maybe 140% fewer African-American owned companies in order for us to have an actual thriving middle class economy. So when you look at statistics like that, you know, those are staggering numbers of where a community like Birmingham actually has to, you know, climb to get out of that. So I think it's a start in the right direction, and it puts a city or regions on the path to being able to, you know, kind of reach financial freedom and generational wealth and growth.
Excellent. Nashley, would you like to respond?
Yeah, so keep in mind that it's an entire ecosystem. You need all the pieces in order for the collective to be successful. And as they say, you're as strong as your weakest link. And so that takes a lot of stakeholders coming together, being willing to work with other people, being willing to bring in other organizations that focus on specific things. I don't believe there can be one organization that does it all, because it's too much. It's a lot of work. And so the work has to be done. You need people specifically focused on each individual task and initiative. And that's how I think it happens.
Excellent. Excellent question. Excellent answers. Just to chime in, you know, I really believe that the American people would be served to really understand the magnitude of what the actual racial wealth gap is. And first, you got to understand that there is a racial wealth gap. Well, first, you got to understand what wealth is, you know, assets minus liabilities. What are assets? What are liabilities? So I think there's basic education that has to be delivered. And you've also got to understand that in context of the African in America from enslavement through just through antiquity, from the Emancipation Proclamation of the Southern slaves through Reconstruction, Deconstruction, Jim Crow, states' rights, the right to vote, you know, right to fair housing, it's, you know, right to education. There's so many parts to really understanding how policy and personal, you know, kind of personal intention was used to keep Black people from accumulating income to accumulate wealth. And so to reverse engineer that, that's going to have to take disruptional transformational policy and also private sector report. So we may not close the racial wealth gap, but we can work to narrow it. In Atlanta, a child born in poverty has a 4% chance of escaping poverty. Think about that. A child born in poverty has a 4% chance in escaping poverty. So that means we have a lot of disruption and transformation to do for parents to be more economically sound and to create wealth so that then they can do the same for their children while we have the participation of everyone in society. And these regional technology hubs, again, we have seen millions of people in the innovation sector through the commercialization of ideas and research and products and services create new wealth with no reliance on pre-existing wealth. I am a testament to that. I know that Wayman is, I know that Nashley is, and I know that Sherry is. Look at us. We come from diverse backgrounds, and we come from diverse ethnicities. And so we're excited to go on this journey with you. Thank you for listening today. And this concludes today's conversation. Thank you.